The Lonely Arts Club is a series of interviews with creative and cultural people discovering their journey into the arts and where it's led them. As we launch series two of The Lonely Arts Club, the UK is under lockdown, meaning the quality of some of our episodes may be slightly different to normal. During this episode, Marta McQuillan is joined by Nisha Katona. Nisha is a curry evangelist, author, and founder of Indian street food restaurant Mowgli. This episode was recorded at the beginning of March, before lockdown restrictions were put in place. We all look forward to eating in Mowgli again once it reopens.
Nisha Katona,
hello.
Welcome to the Lonely Arts Club.
Thank you very much.
You are a fantastically successful entrepreneur, chef, author. Tell us about where you grew up.
Well, I was born and raised in Ormskirk, actually. So actually, I was born in Ormskirk Hospital and I was raised in New Skem. So my parents came over as doctors to Skelmersdale, must be about 50 years ago, as GPs. So that's why I was born in that area of the world. And I was raised there and then went on to work in Liverpool. So I've always remained very, very local. That is, my foot is, you know, between those two camps of West Lancs and Merseyside. That's where I've always existed and have no intention of leaving.
So where did you grow up in Ormskirk?
Latham, actually. So I was, at the age of 10, we moved to kind of a farmstead in Latham. I'm very fond of Edgehill because that's where I used to ride my horse and ride my bike. You know, that was my playground before it was developed into what it is now. So that was all my neck of the woods, Vicarage Lane, etc. So Latham was always home to me and Latham will always sort of partially be home. My mother still lives there. My brother's there with his children and my social group is still out there.
Latham is where during the First World War, where all the war horses were trained.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
State? Oh, well.
I did not know that. Whereabouts? Do you know?
On the park.
That's a nice thought.
So where did your parents come from?
They came from Varanasi and Lucknow. My father was from Lucknow in India. My mother's from Varanasi and Lucknow. And they trained as doctors at Agra Medical School. So they met sort of overlooking the Taj Mahal. And that was the time when Enoch Powell was beckoning Indian doctors to come. There's a shortage here before he tried to throw everyone out. And it was a pretty tough time, actually, because my father was probably one of the first Asian GPs in West Lancs. And it was 1971 when I was born, and it was really hair-raising. It was a tough, tough time to be a brown face in New Skem at that time. You know, so my earliest memories were of bricks being thrown through our windows, being firebombed, racist graffiti. You know, it was just background noise. That was the norm. You'd be spat at on the way to school. My parents would be spat at on the way to work by the very patients they would then treat. And it's a strange thing, you know, and in an attempt to integrate, and this is very typical of Indians, I think, is that we just want you to like us. And the way that we do that is by feeding people. So my parents were extremely hospitable and they loved cooking and they loved horticulture, etc. And so they would invite people around, you know, in the neighbourhood to come and eat, colleagues, neighbours, etc. And it was a real force for breaking down those barriers. You know, suddenly I think when you're eating with people, it's hard to maintain any animosity. You know, suddenly you're understanding every aspect of their humanity because that's manifest in the food and the hospitality that you're given. So it was not an insignificant thing. And I still think I've only got friends because I can cook curry. You know, you realise that it's just such a powerful social force when you can invite people around, when you've got the ability to cook pan loads of gorgeous stuff and no fear of serving them in those pans and inviting people around. It's a great social lubricant.
Sadly, it's not difficult to reimagine that sort of time now. But I'm kind of curious about why, given that experience, and it's actually even more intense than anything that people might be experiencing just now, why did your parents stay?
Why do they stay in the UK?
Yeah.
Because once you have made that move, you have nowhere else to go. You've cut your ties. You've stopped the job in the East. You have a salary, you have security in that, in every other way. You know, you've got a job, you've raised your children, they're in schools here. It's like anybody that is being persecuted in a community. They can't leave. Everything you know is in that. You know, I was born here. I was in nursery here. I was in school here. Remember, my memory started at the age of about four or five. You know, by that time, They have the security of a job. You can't just go back to where you came from, as people would say. So you persevere. And if you start to see a way forward and start to see a bit of change, then the hope springs eternal for humans, doesn't it? You think, okay, this is going to get better. We will make more friends. It will be all right. They'll realise that we're not some alien species that are here to take their women and take their jobs or whatever it might be. So there is always that hope and you work towards it.
So where did you go to school?
I went to school, started off in Mount Carmel in Orton. I don't know if you know that. You may not. Anyway, so Orton, and then I went to Scaresbrick Hall in Southport, and then I went to Winstanley College in Wigan, and then I went to Liverpool Uni and did psychology, which I hated, and then transferred to John Moores to do law. And then you go and study in those days, so that was 1995 that I qualified. I had to go and study in London. You have to go and live in one of the, because I was a barrister, you have to go and live in one of the, or work under one of the inns of court. So I went to Lincoln's Inn, and you have to live in London for a year. And that was a real eye-opener. And then I came back to do my pupillage and practice in Liverpool. For 20 years I practiced.
Let's go back a little bit to New Skem then, and that experience of cooking. Tell us the sorts of things that you would cook.
I wasn't cooking, remember. I was eight or, you know, at the age of...
You were learning to cook.
I wasn't learning to cook. I'll tell you what happens is very typically of immigrant professionals, your children are not taught to cook.
Right.
That's the last place you should be is in the kitchen. You're at the dining table doing homework incessantly because you are trained and raised to be doctors or lawyers. That's what you're raised for. So to be in the kitchen learning how to cook is really, it's just not even an option. What you do learn as a child, it's interesting. So in Western culture, you sort of bake with your nan, you bake cakes. We don't have cakes in India. We don't have ovens, you know, that you bake things in. You learn how to make those flatbreads called chapatis or rotis. So from, you know, as soon as you can use your hands, you have your hands in dough learning how to make the breads. But that's as far as it went. And it's a funny thing because I think neurologically, when you walk into the house and you can smell whatever, cauliflower, you can smell the spice that goes with it. So subliminally, your brain, and this will be true of every culture, is being programmed through the scents in the house, the smells, the aromas. So you kind of know that when you can smell meat curry, there's a, you know, the underlying notes of garlic, onion, ginger. And I realise that is a very powerful thing now because I see it even in my own children, that they would just know that when you're cooking lentils, it's going to be with cumin because the smells that come through the house. What happened in the way that I learnt to cook is that, and this is very typical of second generation Indians, it's only when you need to. So as soon as you start socialising, it could be when you go to uni or you have your own home and you're starting to cook for other people, the easiest thing to cook is big pans full of gorgeous curry, really unctuous, generous and easy. So that's the point at which you start phoning your first generation as your mothers, your aunties, your grandmothers and asking for recipes. And that's how it started. But then what happened with me is I realised that as those first generation immigrants die, they will take with them those formulas and they are very explicable formulas. They will take those with them. The other truth is any of those Indians, like my parents, who could afford the flight ticket to the West and the beginnings of a life in the West will have afforded a chef back at home. Remember, in India, most homes will have two or three members of staff that come in, including a cook. So many of the first generations that came to this country in the 1970s couldn't cook because they had a chef back home. So they too were tenuously learning the recipes by being on the phone or by correspondence in those blue airmail letters back home with India. So we have this very weak grip now in this country on those ancient formulas. And that's why I thought, I'm going to write these in the form of a book, even if I just pass it to my children. They don't then die with me. So once I pass on, at least they'll still taste their mother's dal, which was their grandmother's dal, their great-grandmother's dal, etc. And that was the beginnings of my life as a food writer. So that was while I was at the bar. When I was a barrister, I used to teach Indian cooking as well, because I realised there was a very simple formula behind Indian food. And started to write the book and I sent it off to Jamie Oliver's agent. I just looked in the front of one of his cookbooks, Googled the names, found his agent's name, sent it to her. And, you know, it was a miracle. In 10 minutes she wrote back and said, could we meet on Monday? And that's when I was signed to start something of a bit of a media career and a literary career in food while I was still a barrister.
Well, let's go back a little bit to when you're at school. mm-hmm. working very hard, mm-hmm. doing your homework, and then you work hard enough to go to university. Mm-hmm. At this point, you're not imagining anything other than, well, what are you imagining?
I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a lawyer, a vet. And I really did, because I watched my parents, and it's a great job. It's a really great job. And I used to do part-time work in the surgery, and what a world to turn in. I just think it's still one of the most noble professions in the world. It's just a phenomenal profession. And also, you know, as a daughter of professionals, you're raised to have nothing but disdain for business. You look at the business world, you look at the business world in India, where there is, well, in a, you know, anyway, you look at Philip Green, for goodness sakes, and, you know, the corruption, you know, the Murdoch Empire, the corruption, the the inhumanity, the brutalism, the mercenary, conscienceless images that there are of the business world. Those are not things to aspire to in those, you know, at that time. It's really interesting. And so it was never something that I would have anticipated to go into business. We just thought that was something you do if you really want to get your hands dirty. I'm not justifying that. It's dreadful, because I am a businesswoman and I'm entirely proud of it. And I, you know, it's a great place to be. But those were the misapprehensions that people had, you know, professional. Still, you speak to people who talk about trade. There are certain stratas of society that consider business to be trade and below them. And so there's a lot of work to be done, I think, to speak openly about business and what a conscionable, great place it is and how important it is. I changed dramatically and now I'm a complete business convert.
So what did you learn at university?
What did I learn? I learned for psychology, I learned how much I hated it and how much I'm the kind of person that likes to come to a conclusion. So if I'm investigating something, it's with an aim to fixing it and actually coming up with a decision. In psychology, what you learn is that you investigate and you put both sides of the story, but at no point can you actually come to a conclusion. I found that hugely frustrating. What I love about law is that there is a right and a wrong, and you know what your brief is. So what you learn in your degree is just the discipline of work, I think, that you are self-motivated, that you don't have to work, and if you don't, you won't pass, you won't get the job you want. It's that learning to be completely self-motivated and to be the whip at your own feet. Your own whip at your own feet is a great feeling, as opposed to somebody, you know, didactically telling you what you've got to do. So you learn those skills doing any kind of a university degree, I think. Any kind of university degree is a great thing to do because of that, because of the discipline and learning that self-motivation. But the rest of it comes actually when you're in practice, you know, the learning of how humans work, how to meet them at their lowest point, how to, you know, change their lives for the better. That comes when you are in practice. There's nothing that no part of that could you learn at university.
So when you were going to university in Liverpool, coming from SCEM, were you a commuting student? Or
No. I would never do. No. I lived in halls of residence. That's the point at which you fly the nest. You know, it's about to happen to me with my 18-year-old. So she will fly in September, and there is no way you'd encourage her to stay at home. They need to be socialising. They need to be out there. They need to monitor their own, you know, pasta purchasing or whatever. This is where they find their feet. It's really important.
Good tip for students there.
And
for parents. So what made you want to then convert to being a lawyer?
I didn't really know, because, of course, I come from a background of doctors. My grandparents were doctors. I didn't know much about the law. I didn't know what a barrister was, really. And I was working in a solicitor's office in the summer to make some money, pocket money. And I had to deliver a brief to a set of chambers in Liverpool. And I remember walking in, and I think I had to go to court with this particular chap. And I had never seen anything like it. From the minute I walked into that chambers and met those people and went to court, I absolutely fell in love with every aspect of it. They were self-employed, which is a great thing. They work till 3 a.m. because they want to, because they're motivated to do that. It was complete theatre. It was endlessly stimulating. So every brief you open is completely gripping and completely different. And I did that. And for 20 years, it's like not having worked a day in your life, which is incredible, because you open a brief out of choice, because it's fascinating. It's, you know, you're these are people's lives. What an honour that you're dealing with people's lives. And then to try and find a way through it for them, you know, to dispassionately step back and see how do we fix this for them. And it's not always the, very rarely is it the in child protection, which is what I did, it's very rarely the outcome that they would necessarily want, but it's what's best for the child. I just thought it was endlessly delicious, really, really, and important, I think.
And you did your pupillage in Liverpool?
I did, yeah.
Why did you want to still be in Liverpool?
As opposed to being anywhere else?
As opposed to you've got such interests and such horizons. Why did you... Other people might think, well, I'll try London, I'll try Manchester, I'll try...
It's a good question. I'll tell you what happens in London is that each set of chambers would have, in those days, they, and I think they still really do, take about 10 pupils and then one of you would get tenancy. And the other thing about being in London is the circuit is enormous. So in terms of travel every day, you could be actually all over the country. So the quality of life that you have is grim. You know, then you've got your accommodation costs and your rents are much higher as a barrister. So you're left with very little money. You're left with very little, because you're travelling, you've got very little time to spend the money that you do make. The quality of life in the provinces as a barrister is far better. So chambers would only take on a pupil because their intention was to keep on that pupil, or they'd take on two. So can you see why, you know, if you can stomach being outside of London, and I really do say that because even as a business person now, I see the anxiety that people have about building a business outside of London. It's as though London is the only source of oxygen in the country, and it's ridiculous. I built a chain outside of London and have continued to do that and intend to continue to do that. But it's this, you know, it's all of the same thing. So your money goes a lot further here. You know, my rents was, I was one of the first people, you know, when the city centre started burgeoning again, it was a like the Marie Celeste, the city centre of Liverpool, but we took a flat there because it was really cheap. Nobody was living there. And so your quality of life is much, much better. And this is my neck of the woods. You know, my social group are here. My family are here. Why would I want to be any more than, you know, 25 minutes away from my mum and her food and the dogs and my dad and all of that? You know, I'm a home bird and I always will be.
So you're a very successful barrister at this point. And then you sit down and write a cookery book.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, were you thinking, this is a hobby, or you think this could be something else?
I always thought it was a hobby. I would never think it could be something. Do you know what the crazy thing is? There's still part of me that thinks this could all fail and I could go back to the bar. There is never that. Perhaps I'm growing out of that a little bit now, but you never just think that this rope that I've swung to is a completely secure one. You know, and it's business at the end of the day, and you look at what's happening. So there's always part of you that humbly thinks this could disappear tomorrow. So the writing of the cookbook, of course, you're never going to make it, unless you're Jamie Oliver, you never make enough money to, you don't make enough money from a book to do your weekly shop. Do you know what I mean? Books don't make you money at all. Books make you money if you then have a massive TV deal, and then it's the Cinderella story, you know, where you are then selling like Nigella or Jamie, but having an inconspicuous cookbook is a work of complete passion and dedication. It's, you can't be doing it for the money, I can tell you that.
So why did you then decide, you know what, I'm going to stop being a barrister and I'm going to open a restaurant? What was the motivation there?
That's entrepreneurism, and entrepreneurism, I think, is like a disease. I do believe the world kind of divides into two kinds of people. There are the entrepreneurs and there are those that are not burdened with such discontent. With entrepreneurs, I think if you have a skill or an idea that meets a gap in the market that you can uniquely fill because of your skill or your passion, then that thing very often comes alive and it does not let you rest. And furthermore, if you don't attempt it, you will live a kind of half shadow life. That's the disease of the entrepreneur. And that's what happened to me. So while I was a barrister, every weekend I would teach people how to cook Indian cookery. My shadow life was dedicated to being a curry evangelist, teaching. As I said, when the first generation's Indians die, these recipes will die with them. It's my duty as a second generationer to pass these recipes to the Brits so that they can cook it. So, you know, I started to think, you know, if I'm physically addicted to this food, then maybe others might be too. And it was unrepresented on the high street. Curry houses don't represent how Indians eat at home. They represent something beautiful. And we stand on the shoulders of curry houses. But That's not how Indians eat at home. Even the nomenclature of those menus means nothing to us. And that was what Mowgli was predicated on, was the way that Indians eat at home. And I did not want to open a restaurant for the reasons I told you. But furthermore, if you look at the hospitality industry and the brutality of it and the testosterone-ridden intolerance of it that you see in the kitchens, you know, the Gordon Ramsay way of doing things, there's nothing about that that beckons a middle-aged woman with children. There's nothing about that that beckons anyone with any humanity. This crushing of people and rebuilding them into some, you know, I'm very disdainful of that. And so I didn't want to do it, but this thing really started to tap me on the shoulder when I was trying to sleep. And I thought, what I'll do is get a little kiosk and I'll just sell 3 curries and roti breads out of this kiosk. You know, even while I was a barrister, I was just trying to do that as a bit of a sideline, but nobody would take me seriously. The banks wouldn't take me seriously. Liverpool One thought I was losing my mind. You know, who am I with no covenant strength to go up against someone like Krispy Kreme, understandably. And so it then came to the point where, honestly, I remember finding myself almost sitting on Bowl Street. So during lunch breaks and at the end of the court day, I would go and sit in different areas and just watch footfall and see what kind of people were going to a certain area. Could I fit in there? And I remember sitting outside Leaf, and it was so busy, and the people in there just looked so aspirational for me. You know, there were these bohemians sitting there with their books and a coffee, and I thought, God, I would love to be worthy of that kind of audience. And I remember falling into it. You know, there was a sign above the shop next door, which was a Chinese shop. I don't remember it, called the Pearl House, I think. And I phoned the number, and it was the only building available on Bold Street. And the landlord came out in about 20 minutes. He happened fortuitously to be around the corner. And when I walked in, I got this, and I choose every single one of my sites. And I walk in, and I either get that feeling or I don't. And if I don't, we walk away. And I got this feeling of warmth, like you've walked into a second home or a home, that feeling when you walk into the right house. And that gave me real kind of confidence that we could give this a go. But then, you know, it was the financial risk. It was all my savings, the roof over my head. We were going to lose our house, you know, if this didn't work. So I kind of was poised to move into my auntie's bungalow in the early days. You know, we could just about afford the pans, etc. And it was really hard. So I carried on working at the bar in the day. And then at night, I would physically bill the restaurant myself. And the only way I saw the children is when they would be brought into the restaurant, into the building site to do their homework. And that's the way it is. That's what entrepreneurial life is like. You know, there is huge risk, and you sleep about 3 hours a night, and you don't presume it's going to be successful.
What did your family think when you told them this is what you wanted to do?
I think the thing is, as long as I was still a barrister, my family were kind of okay. My Indian family in India thought I was mad, really, and not just mad, but this is really quite a crisis that I was having. My mother, it's a strange thing, was always support. We are real foodies in our family. And, you know, we really are passionate about these dishes. And so I think because I was still at the bar, she was very supportive, and actually always has been. It's always been an exciting thing for her. I think there are many, many people like us that are latent food entrepreneurs, and that's why I'm very happy to tell the story, because I think there's lots of people out there who, like me, reach a certain stage of life, or whatever stage of life, and you think, can I bring my grandmother's jam to the market? Could I bring, you know, my auntie's biscuits to the market? And I think telling the warts and all story is really important. I may yet fail, and I will talk about the failure if and when I do, because people need to know what that landscape is like as an entrepreneur.
You want to unpack the concept behind Mowgli a little bit for me? So curry houses, which is probably how most British people have experienced Indian cuisine. What's your issue with curry houses?
There's no issue with curry houses. My issue is that the way that Indians actually eat at home is not represented on the high street. So without even looking over my shoulder at curry houses, I'm not really bothered about what curry houses are doing or not doing. What I am bothered about is the fact that the majority of the British public don't know what to do with a bag of lentils. That hurts me, because lentils are amazing, and they're cheap, and they're healthy, and they're plant-based, and all of those things that are incredible. It's that. It's how do you cook dal. So I was bothered about teaching them how to cook, remember. So I'm what? Cabbage. Your overwintered British veg are the best one of the best ingredients you could ever cook with, you know, for curries, etc. And so it was about showing them that this is so if they came round to my house at 10 o'clock at night when everyone's, you know, the curtains are drawn, this what I feed them in Mowgli is what they'd be fed at home. So my house smells like Mowgli. And it's so different. It's we don't cook with ghee. There is a ban on any cream in Mowgli. We don't cook with cream because that's not how Indians eat. We don't have naan breads and poppadoms. That's just not. Indians don't have tandoor ovens in their homes. Everything is cooked fresh, you know, with rapeseed oil. It's low fat. It's gluten free completely. You know, it's the majority of our menu is plant based. And that's how Indians eat. And that was not represented. And so that was the basis of Mowgli to start with. The other really important factor for me was if I am this curry evangelist, then what I should be doing and what I did and always have is take curry Scouser, curry virgins, and train them how to cook. If I'm dependent on an Indian body of chefs, then this business was going to go nowhere. And also, I think them being told what to do by this short little gobby brown woman was never going to work. What also happens with Indians is we're very passionate about our food. So if you gave me a job as a head chef in a restaurant, an Indian restaurant, I would change the food so it tastes like my grandmother's or my mother's. And that's what happens is that we are so passionate and so driven by flavour and by flavour being reminiscent of what we know. It's better to get people that don't have those references that can come to it with an open mind and know that what I'm teaching them is the way that they have to do it, that it's specced like paracetamol. So do not mess with the cumin. Don't add less or more. You do it according to spec so that there's complete consistency. And when you have that humility and that consistency amongst your chefs, then you can roll the concept out and have it consistent.
So who are your chefs?
Who are they? They're from all over the world, really, our chefs. They are people that don't know how to cook curry, but are passionate about food and flavour. Those are the two criteria. And the other important thing for chefs is that, and according, you know, I hold every single member of staff up to three criteria in Mowgli. Are they full of grace, intelligence and graft? Those are the three criteria. Every decision I make, is it full of grace, intelligence and graft? And those are my chefs, people who thrive on being busy, people who have got the intelligence to learn this entirely different food culture and adhere to it and understand the tastings of it. I also have, in terms of the grace, it's really important in kitchens from what I described to you, the Gordon Ramsay way of doing things. Because I worked with domestic violence for so long and, you know, violence in home, I have a zero tolerance policy on any bullying, on any raised voices, any aggression across the whole of Mowgli. The minute we have that, I'm afraid you're gone. We just don't tolerate that. And so it's things like that. It's having people with that frame of mind that's set within those parameters of grace, intelligence and graft.
So what happened when you opened your first restaurant on Bold Street? Was it an overnight success or did you spend a week with no customers? Or
it was an overnight success. And I tell you why. And this is the power of social media. Before I even built Mowgli, while I was musing and while I, you know, was putting a menu together on a whiteboard in my living room with my mum and my kids or whatever, you know, I started a Facebook page and just threw it out to the people, you know, that I knew. If I was to build a restaurant with these dishes, would you buy these dishes? Would you pay this for them? And because I do think lots of people are vicariously watching this journey, thinking they could do it and they'd probably do it better than me, it's great. So they are very collaborative. And the name even, I had three names. Now, in fact, I wanted to call it Rickshaw, but there were three. The pet name that I have for my daughters is Mowgli, so that's where Mowgli came from. It's a Bengali word. We speak Bengali. Rickshaw and Mongoose, these were the three names. I even put that out to social media and said, look, which one would you prefer? And in this really collaborative way, people started to direct the business for me. So before I even had bricks and mortar, I had the name, I had the menu, I had the prices, I had the design idea. I'd started buying things off eBay and I was sharing. So by the time that door opens, this city is so amazing in that way. These people were at the door ready to see what this thing is that they'd birthed. And that is how I continue to be. But you know, today I'm designing leads. And there is a wall that I don't know what to do with. So I put it out to Instagram. I do every word of social media. It's one of the last things I'll give up. So I don't have a marketing department. We've never advertised. I have no PR. everything I do myself through social media. But I will throw out this wall. In fact, I did on Instagram. So people have got their views on whether it should be. My big profound question is, can I get away from the green and gold monkey? Or is that my brand? And people are saying, no, it's your brand, stick to it. So now we've designed it up again and I'll put it on Instagram later on. You know, and I build Mowgli completely collaboratively. And that's why, thank heavens, I think we are busy because people are proprietorial. And what I love is actually if they're not happy with it, they will Facebook message me and tell me that they went in and it was not so great or whatever. And I actually do something about it immediately. And so there is this, it's for the people, you know, this restaurant.
At what point, having just got yourself through the opening a restaurant in Bow Street, you said, you know what, I need more of this.
I'll tell you when. What happened exactly is that, you know, we opened within about 3 weeks. I had my first offer of investment. Can you imagine? That's incredible. And I had no idea that this would be a success. So little idea did I have that I negotiated a 2-year break clause on my lease because I thought she would fail within 2 years. Also, I design every brick of Mowgli and I designed her in a way that I could pull Indian food out and put coffee in the next day because I was convinced she'd fail. But when you start getting offers of investment and they came thick and fast after about 3 weeks, you think there is something in this. When people say to you, you have a brand here that you could do something with, it would be reckless not to consider that at least. And I loved it. And I believe in her and I believe in the food. And, you know, every Mowgli I produce, she produces £40,000 worth of charitable giving. You know, we give over £500,000 a year to local charities through the trust and create over, whatever, 40 jobs per Mowgli. Why would I not build it? I pay good taxes. You know, I create jobs every time I build it. If I'm brave enough to build her, she will go into cities and enrich lives in those cities. Why would I not do that? And it was when I had that realisation that this is not, because whatever Mowgli made, we were still shopping at Lidl. You know what I mean? We were really hand to mouth because whatever she made went back into Mowgli. There was no funding. I didn't take investment. You know, this was still just me and a spanner, you know. And I thought, why wouldn't I take it to Manchester? Why not try it? And people, remember the social media following was saying, please bring it to X, please bring it to Y. And when you take a step back and you think about business as being this thing that creates jobs, that creates wealth, that creates social capital, then we have a duty, if it's something great, to build it. Let's have the confidence to build it, especially when people around your communities are supportive of that. And that's what made me build my second Mowgli, entirely out of the money that the first Mowgli made. And the third Mowgli came out entirely out of the money that the first two had made. You're still there is no amelioration of risk. You know, even for 3 years, you're still thinking you couldn't make any plans because you just could have ended up bankrupt if, you know, the next day it was like that. And so that's why I build, and that's why I build now, and that's why I don't have any sleepless nights being proud about this being a national chain, probably the first Indian national chain, truly, to come out of the northwest of England with a person at the helm of it who had no idea about business, that came to it at 45 years of age, having no idea about business, you know, and to be able to create that many jobs and that much money for charities. And why would I not grow it? It's my duty.
Tell me about the foundation.
The trust.
What does it do?
When I started Mowgli, I realised that my aim with Mowgli is, you know, you've got to think about why you do this. It's not just about creating good curry. It's about enriching lives. So I build Mowgli so that she enriches lives in the cities that we go to, starting with our staff, then our communities through, you know, whatever we support, our local charities, and then our customers through social, you know, capital, having somewhere delicious to spend their money. And the way that you can best enrich the lives of these 20-year-olds that come and work for me is for them to come into work and it to feed them in every way, spiritually, emotionally, physically, intellectually. I need my staff to feel purposeful, nourished and fulfilled. That's my aim, purposeful, nourished and fulfilled. And the way you do that is for them to come in and have some kind to be outward facing, something that lifts their head out of the mire. They work really hard and I want their life to be a joy. I want it to be more fun coming into work than being out of work. So having an allied charity to each one of our restaurants, we have a local charity that co-parents with me, I call it co-parenting, and each site has a charity champion, a dedicated charity champion, and we organise, you know, events for our staff to do, you know, so sponsored this and sponsored that. We send at least 40 members of Mowgli teams to India to work on land management projects and female entrepreneurship, etc., you know, bringing clean water to villages. So we've got certain villages that we dedicate and we pay them while they're there to do that. For every full-time member of staff we take on, we sponsor a child in need. And it's not just sponsoring a child in need. Our staff write and interact with those children. We will then send our teams out to go and meet those children in February of next year. And that's what the trust is about. So not only do we, you know, it's over 500,000 a year. Not only that, it's what it does to your teams. You know, it's how it elevates your teams. And the best thing will be if those members of my teams go on to build their own businesses with charitable giving as a central limb. I think it's really important that that's what we do.
So what's the limit for Mowgli? When is enough enough?
No, I can't see a limit for Mowgli. Enough's enough when people don't want us anymore. When I stop eating in my restaurant every day, I eat in Mowgli twice a day, every day. At the weekends, I'm back in Mowgli because the family want to come and eat in Mowgli because it's what I cook. It's my food. You know, it's easier than me cooking at home. We'll just nip to Mowgli because it's my food. It's really interesting. When you look at some of the brands that have gone under, the common theme for me is when I look at them, I think, when was the last time I actually craved that food? When was the last time I actually ate there for these brands that go under? And I can't remember. You are only as good as your last curry. Your food has to be addictive. I think there are three phases to any brand. I think there's adoption, there is addiction and allegiance. Adoption is where, you know, we're probably at the adoption stage right at the beginning. We're 5 years in and people are looking at the brand and thinking, do you fit with our family? Do you have the same values? Are you a safe place for my children to go? Are you, you know, do you fit the family? And once they adopt you, your food has to be addictive. Your product has to be nothing less than physiologically addictive. And if you look at all the brands that have stood the test of time, Nando's, I don't care what else they have on the menu, I'll have half chicken chips and, you know, whatever, medium peri-peri sauce. You don't need to keep changing a menu. You need a core menu to which people are addicted. And then comes the allegiance. And we're too early in the game to even think about not slowing, it's not about pace, to think about the end, because at the moment we're still having people calling for us to go to certain cities. Every day we'll have at least, you know, 10 tweets saying, could you please come to Portsmouth or come to Exeter or come to Glasgow? And I listen to them, you know, and I go and scope these places depending on where they're calling us. Once my food stops being addictive and people don't want it and people stop calling, then I will get off the high street. That's all I can say, but I can't see a limit to where Mowgli can go.
Now, you say you came to this in your 40s not knowing anything about business. Is this a model that can be repeated, or does everybody have to find their own way as an entrepreneur?
I think one of the best things for me has been that I have had experience and age on my side. So a business that is human-centric, to have been a child protection barrister where you are looking at what makes humans tick, at how you give them hope, at listening to what it is that they need from you, having all your corners knocked off in terms of your pride, coming to a business that runs on humans later in life for me has been the best thing. You know, there's no hubris on my part. There's no pride. I'm not flighty. This isn't a project that I'm going to move on to the next project. My entire life depends on Mowgli's success, and Mowgli's success depends on those humans being happy, those people that I employ being fulfilled, nourished and purposeful. And I think things like, you know, the dreadful things that life can throw at you just softens you and brings you to this place where you're in a far better position to manage and construct people policies, cultures, because of, you know, because you've lived a bit. So I think it's a really encouraging story because I started as a barrister. I would never have guessed that this is where I'd end up. And this is, you know, these are the doors that happen to have opened for me. It's really strange. And it's working so far. So it's an encouraging tale that you can come to this new wonderful horizon later on in life.
And what's next for you personally?
Mowgli, I can't see past the next hour, if I'm honest with you. Honestly, I can't. We're at such a pace. I will continue to remain CEO of Mowgli. There'll come a point when when my knees go and then I'll become something else within Mowgli. But I don't have another project like this in me. I don't need another project like this in me. This is all encompassing.
But what's your next book?
I think I need to do something like a healthy curry. I think people still think curry is not healthy. But here's my passion: 25 minutes and super low calorie curry, because that's actually what it is and that's what Mowgli is. You know, if you can't cook it in 25 minutes in my house, I'm not interested in it. And curry is naturally extremely healthy. So I think there's something around that I need to start thinking about.
Nisha Katona, curry evangelist, businesswoman, superb. Do come back to the Lonely Arts Club with your next book and some healthy curry for us.
I'll do that. Thank you very much.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast is brought to you by the Institute for Creative Enterprise at Edgehill University, making connections through culture. I'm editor and producer Roz Power, with audio production by Sam August of Onomatopoeia Studios in Liverpool. For further details on the work of the Institute for Creative Enterprise and courses at Edgehill University, visit www.edgehill.ac.uk/ICE.